To me, today will be one of the more important aspects of our look at peacemaking as far as Christians are concerned. Much of the rest, be looking at arguments and things that could be made by anybody. When I talk with church people, about issues of foreign policy, war and peace, we often spend a lot of time arguing over various treaties or peace initiatives or various moves for disarmament and things like that. But I like at least some point in the discussion to get around to the question, what do you do with Jesus? And it's a question that I think is a very valid one for those of us who call Jesus Lord. And often the response, very often, the sort of response, if you get any response at all, the response is something like, well, in this issue I really don't do anything with Jesus. We're dealing here with the real world. And I respond to that if Jesus doesn't have something to do with the most, what I would call the most important issue facing the world today, then Jesus really is not of much use to us, at least much earthly use, maybe some heavenly use. And if Jesus is Lord of life, Jesus is Lord of all life, including our political life, including military life. And I think in discussions that when we as Christians stick to the theological, that we're on ground, that we have perhaps some expertise, as opposed to arguing statistics, arguing different policies, that this is where Christians have some sort of unique perspective to bring to the whole discussion. So what do you do with Jesus?
Four questions. Is Jesus the Messiah? In some sense, the unique revelation did Jesus use / espouse violence? Does the messianic ethic use or espouse violence? That is, if we can draw some ethics from Jesus, you know, or another way of putting this, is the messianic community, the church today, allowed to use violence? Niebuhr, this is Reinhold Niebuhr, would argue, or would state, yes, Jesus was the Messiah. No, Jesus did not use or espouse violence. That Jesus, using today's words, Jesus was a pacifist, recognizing that pacifism really is a modern term, but I think it's an okay one for this case. That Jesus was a pacifist, Niebuhr would agree with that, but would say that we live in different conditions and times today, that we followers of Jesus are not required to eschew violence. We may use violence in certain circumstances because that is the lesser of some evil choices that we have. I think there's very little argument about whether or not Jesus used violence, but there is some. We'll take a look at that right now. Any questions or comments? These questions here.
So you
Well, yeah, for one thing, Christians are in power today, in political power, which they weren't in Jesus' day. And if we're going, and his book, Christ and Culture, or Immoral Man and Immoral Society, Moral Man and Immoral Society, deal with the questions that we're faced with because we're in power. Christians have power today, political power, which they didn't at that time.
That sort of rings in my ears, like when the Israelites wanted a king.
Well,
when the king goes, you know, we'll read the scripture and he'll do all the good things to do.
Okay, maybe. Yeah, I'd encourage you, if you're, you know, interested, to read him firsthand. I think what I've said so far is fair. Niebuhr, I picked out Niebuhr as being one of the better known theologians arguing that position, which is, I would say, a pretty common position in the church today. It would be very interesting. Niebuhr died in, about 63 or something like that. I can't remember exactly. 68 maybe. I think it would be real interesting to see where he'd be today, given the technology of today. For instance, his colleague John C. Bennett, the fellow I took the class from that really had such an effect on me, agreed with Niebuhr, you know, that nuclear weapons and all these things are terrible, but we really need a deterrence, that that's the moral Christian thing to do. Still agreed with that position when I had the class in 1975. His recent writings have come out much more towards what we call a nuclear pacifist stance, saying, given the technology, I'm forced to a position of pacifism, that these weapons are so awful. That's how I understand a couple of his latest articles. Well, anyway. Let's define violence. Go ahead, shoot some words or phrases out which we think are legitimate.
Bodily harm.
To cause someone bodily harm?
Yeah, we're talking about psychological violence. I mean, what are we talking about here?
Well, that's what we're trying to find out. Will you include that?
It's such a broad term.
Okay, right, that's what we're going to try to... We're going to list everything we want, and then we're going to decide of those which ones we think are legitimate, which ones not. Okay. You mentioned psychological. What, do any more? Maybe psychological.
Cultural. Physiological.
Okay, David, what were you saying? Suffering.
Okay. Aggression.
Not doing too well. Anything else?
Rape, which to be physical.
Okay, that would be under physical bodily harm, mental, psychological.
Victim.
Pardon me?
The victim, well, not maybe not always, but some thing or person receiving.
Perpetrator and
action.
It's a victim.
Okay. How about something about intentional? I mean, Sal was harmed yesterday. I don't know if you'd say that was violence. You know, nobody intended to hurt him in that basketball game.
There's malice involved.
Yeah.
Or intention, right.
Okay, yeah, we'll put it down here with malice, okay? Anymore?
Some violence is not intentional.
Yeah.
Well, I guess that you're talking about.
Well, let's just, okay, for a given example.
Well, you might, out of impulse, you could out of impulse shoot somebody.
As
I mean, that's
reaction,
a violent act, but it's not, it might not be, it might just be a reaction. Well,
you're thinking of premeditated and intention as the same. Intentional.
Yeah, premeditated intentional.
You're saying it isn't always premeditated.
Yeah, self-inflicted.
Can you tear a range off the wall that's not intentional? I mean, you know, I don't think you always know that.
Well, I was just trying to distinguish between, is violence always intentional?
Violence can be the result of an unintentional act.
How? Or an example?
Violence in terms of hungry people dying. That's violence.
Okay.
And injustice causes that.
Okay. So there's institutional violence.
Mm-hmm.
Institutionalized injustice.
Intrapersonal violence, violence against oneself, bulimics, anorexics, alcoholics.
Okay, would that be to cause bodily or psychological harm?
Every bit of, to others or bodily harm them is violence?
I took a class on peace and violence, and we had discussed interpersonal violence, intrapersonal violence, institutional violence, violence against land.
Well, that's giving it a very, very broad interpretation,
but
that's not necessarily the interpretation.
Okay, well, let's come up with one that we can agree on, I hope. So are we talking about violence just against people, or are we, or do we want to make it larger than that?
Institutional violence, too.
Why do we want to talk about it? I mean, I guess that's part of it.
Well, so that when we get to talking about specific passages and say, does Jesus use or allow violence here, or does something else, we know what we're talking about. Mm. Whether we're saying, for instance, to yell, perhaps, at the money changers or to overthrow their tables, is that violence? Or does Jesus have to physically or psychologically hurt them? I mean, is a loud noise violence or...
I think I would narrow it down to more of a bodily, physical harm and I understand that a psychological violence can be very crippling, but in the sense of if we're going to talk about culture, counterculture, and not being in the mainstream and living a different life, well, that could create friction with other people, and so there is some form of uneasiness that's unavoidable. But I don't think I'd call that particularly violence. So I think I would lean towards narrowing it towards physical harm. In other words, you could...
Would you call that uneasiness psychological harm?
Somebody's pride very badly, but maybe that pride needs to be hurt. But the person has the ability to, I think, heal themselves, but as opposed to a person that gets violently maimed or even killed, there is no, after the person's dead, form of healing can there be for that person?
Okay.
So I would know that.
If a person's pride is hurt, is that psychological harm? Or is that psychological healing?
It depends on the case.
Well,
that's right.
I mean, if as you said, if their pride needs it. Well, anything else on this? Anything else about psychological? Any other feelings?
I was going to say it after Auschwitz and those places. The Jews were herded there, and the ones who were killed right at the minute they got there, they were the lucky ones, because from then on they wondered, is today my day or is tonight my day? And so that was violence to the first, but also more maybe to the other ones.
So you're arguing in favor of keeping psychological in the definition?
I'm not against keeping that in the definition, but I'm wondering for purposes of what we're using it, if we leave it too broad, it's going to be awfully hard for us to deal more specifically with why we but I just think if you get it too broad in all these, it's going to take a long time to decide whether Jesus or whether the messianic ethic uses violence and so on, if we spread it out in this really broad interpretation.
But I think the messianic ethic is broad
But I wonder if we have to focus on that word harm then. If someone says something that makes clear go into a tantrum and has a suffering, that isn't necessarily being violent.
And presumably no one's doing that intentionally.
Yeah.
I mean, when we're dealing, I've not seen anyone intentionally harm Claire.
Something we have to add there to that to cause bodily. What kind of harm? Permanent harm or not just some temporary thing? Would that be part of it?
Well, you mean the results being...
Yeah, whether is the violence...
I can just see us getting out. Are we going to say that because Jesus said to the fig tree, you will bear no more fruit, and then we have ecological harm, so then Jesus is causing violence. Is this the kind of thing we're dealing with too? Are we spreading out too much to really focus in on what we're...
Well,
that's
the dog here, Bill.
For me?
You're the theologian here. Help us out. But how should we narrow it?
Ecological is a big process of a cycle.
Yes, it's running something.
Well, then I agree with how we put it in context.
I don't think harm is necessarily violent.
That's what
you think. Whether we need a stronger word there, or is it permanent harm or damage?
Yeah. Harm seems like a weak word.
Damage. Damage sounds like a bad word.
You know, Kathy Brown's got a great definition of violence. She's a book, Religion and Violence, in the library.
If it's not checked out, the library owns it. Do you want damage here instead of harm?
Yeah.
Okay, if there's some damage, is there going to be suffering?
Yeah. Yeah, I would say so.
I would say so.
By what we're understanding.
What about this one? I have some trouble with this one, aggression.
Well,
is all aggression violent?
To me, yes.
Okay.
I mean, is violent on the person feeling it? Is that what you meant?
Is
the act of aggression is violent?
Okay, if I'm playing rugby and I aggressively, you know, go out and tackle somebody and bring him to the ground, is that violent?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I see that as a very violent game. People get hurt.
It might not cause damage.
It's kind of like it might.
Yeah, but
and it's not intentional, but...
Well, the same thing. I was trying to avoid some of the more
all
connotations that we
get. What about, say, in work? Some people are very aggressive. Is aggression an act different from being aggressive? We sometimes see being aggressive as a virtue.
Well, I know. I think assertiveness is a virtue, but aggression is asserting your, or not asserting, but
running
making your personality dominant on that person. That's domination, involves domination and a bunch of other things that, I guess, it can cause violence, but I don't say it's a natural consequence of that. Don't cross it out, it's just in my first
You can
definition.
Put victim in your top line if you want to add it to cause violence, damage to a victim.
Okay, how about destruction, sabotage of physical things rather than people? For the purpose of our discussion, should we leave that out?
Discussion, I think we could leave that.
Yeah, we could argue that one. I mean, I could see both sides of that one. I'm certainly not in favor of blowing up things.
Implied in damage.
Yeah. But to a victim rather than to a building or something.
Well, building can be a victim.
Well,
is a victim always a person?
Well, what do we want in our definition?
That are being slaughtered, or a victim can be any group or anything.
Can we limit our definition to people? Rather than getting in an argument about vegetarianism, or
yeah, sure.
Okay, to human.
Or tearing down an old building.
Brown talks about covert and overt violence, and he wants to expand the meaning of the word far beyond the ordinary usage. When you think of the word violence, think of it as describing an overt physical act of destruction. Someone is roughed up, pushed around, hit, stabbed, shot, raped, or in some other way made the object of physical abuse. When you can see, when you talk about it that way, you can see it and feel it. They make the instances of violence tangible and clear cut. But his main thesis for the book is to talk about the personhood. The basic overall definition of violence would then become violation of personhood. While such a denial or violation can involve the physical destruction of personhood in ways that are obvious, personhood can also be violated or denied in subtle ways that are not obvious at all, except to the victim. There can be violation of personhood quite apart from doing physical harm. And the text, war is the most obvious example of violence.
I guess that's where I see aggression coming in, is that it's taking away my personhood. It's trying to dominate me.
Psychological.
Okay. I guess normally where I come down to in this is intentionally to cause physical or psychological harm, thinking that being human victims, and also want some sort of recognition of the violence of institutions, that lead to hunger, or that an economic system in a country where most of the peasants are landless is a violent system, or most of the peasants have no access to the economic pie, if we put it that way. That will cause them physical harm. People are hungry, the way the institutions are set up. Okay? That agreeable? Okay, now, as part of this definition, we'll include the use of military force. Agreed? That if you use military force even to defend yourself, the object of that is to cause physical harm and psychological harm as well. Okay? All right, if we need to, we'll come back to these definitions.
Good, good.
Yeah.
But what do you do with police force then?
Let's come back to that, okay? Yeah, be sure to bring that up again. That is it's a good question. It's one I continue to wrestle with. Okay. I lost my Bible here yesterday. Has anybody seen a Good News Bible without a cover on it?
Yes, in the reference room library.
Okay, thanks. I'll just use one of these for now. All right. Anybody have some text that they want to submit?
Romans 13.
Okay, Romans 13. Are arguing in favor of the use of violence.
Mm-hmm.
Others?
What you said was biblical passages supporting the military defense.
Okay.
You didn't really need just defense. So did you, if you're using things like Romans 13, often this is offense, right?
Okay.
So you want it in the broader sense.
Yeah.
You
defense
can't
or
really find much in defense, but you're
no,
actually defending.
Sorry. I was trying to broaden
you
that
mean
rather
to say
than narrow.
Defense
it.
Of militarism, maybe?
Well,
question
in use of military.
Yeah, okay.
Or in use of violence, shall we say.
In Matthew it says, all who take the sword will perish.
Okay, do you have the...
Matthew 26, 52.
Okay.
What are we giving here? Against?
That would be against, wouldn't it?
Well, a lot of people have used it as... being an argument in favor of righteous use of the sword. These people use the sword, so we're going to take up the sword and make them perish by it.
Luke 22:35 is the one about buy a sword.
Okay.
35 to 38.
All right. Matthew 22:21 is rendered, therefore, it's seized of the things that are seized of the God, the things of God.
Which is Matthew 22? Matthew 22:21.
Mm-hmm, right.
Okay.
Matthew 24:6. There will be wars and rumors of wars. Like this, there's going to be.
Okay.
Can't read it. Huh?
Oh yeah, I'm sorry. I don't know. One more chance here.
Some people use John 2:15, cleansing the temple.
Okay. A lot of people do. Yeah, that's much, isn't that fun? Marker that works.
Romans 13 and Titus 3 and 1 Peter 2 all have that every person be subject to the ruling authorities, or be submissive to rulers and authorities, or be subject to every human institution.
Okay. Yep.
And then when they asked John the Baptist, what shall we do with the coming of the kingdom? And the soldiers came and said, what shall we do? He didn't say, leave the military. He
okay.
said...
What's that? John 3?
No, it's in Luke 3.
Luke 3. I knew that. Just testing. what verses do you remember?
Around 10 to 11, no one by violence is verse 14.
Okay.
Be content with your wages.
Others?
This is, as I call the New Testament, I'm sure the Old Testament is very supportive, but I can't keep it.
There's lots in the Old Testament.
Yeah, I have some from the Old Testament.
Okay.
I think of Gideon, Judges 6:14, and David, he was so warlike. Where is David?
Gideon would be the
2 Samuel 22:41, Judges 3:2, teach them war that had not known war, Joshua.
That was Judges 3:2?
Yes.
Jeremiah
48:10,
as cursed is he who keeps back his sword from bloodshed.
Okay, that's a beautiful. 48:10?
Yes, Jeremiah.
How about this one, Deuteronomy, 28th chapter. You have to do the whole chapter, but I picked out 4 verses.
Okay.
1, 7, 15, 25.
All right.
Lots in Deuteronomy where it talks about going out and defeating your enemies and so on all over.
Okay.
In Joshua 10:40, God commands the Israelites to wipe out their enemies. In 1 Samuel 15:1-3, the Lord of hosts says, destroy them all.
Okay. Others that you're dying to have us look at? I don't know that we're going to get to all these, but we'll get to some of them. Okay, let's start with this one. John 2:15, cleansing of the temple. Also in Matthew and Luke. In fact, I think it's helpful to look at it in one of the parallels. So, let's talk about that. What do you think? Is Jesus using violence there, by our definition?
I don't know, is he...
Thank you.
I don't think he did any damage to human victims.
Okay, didn't do damage, didn't... We're quite sure that he didn't do any physical damage from the Greek text. And... how about psychological damage?
That might be hard to know. You could spend a lot of time arguing.
Okay, why would you say yes, David?
If he didn't, you would, I don't think he would have done the person if he didn't intend to.
If he weren't going to cause psychological damage, he wouldn't have bothered to do it?
But
damage is a proof. You think that is a proof thing, not just teaching a lesson.
Why?
Well, I wouldn't consider it violence. If my father scolds me so that I don't touch an electric wire and electrocute myself, I wouldn't call that psychological damage. I would call that unnecessary teaching.
Because if you include all teaching like that as damage, then it's so wide open.
If the policeman stops me from speeding at 90 miles an hour and gives me a ticket, I wouldn't call that psychological damage.
Well, I just don't think of it as being teaching.
But that was his purpose, to teach that the temple had to be cleansed. He wasn't trying to harm them.
Okay, say some more, David.
I think it was an act of passion. It was an act to offend someone. Not necessarily to cause people now, but to offend someone. In some sense, I think a lot of reservoir, all of civil disobedience is psychological violence. It's not causing any permanent,
it's not like you're going to cause somebody to be psychologically crippled all in one, but they're causing some type of temporary harm, so people think about what is, you know, why they did it.
Do you want that included in the
definition? But if you put that in violence, then everything is violent. Then you, how do you differentiate between civil disobedience and violent resistance?
Yeah, I guess I
just... The people who don't do anything are not being violent. But the people who are involved actively.
But you don't see any difference between people making with posters and making a march, and those who go out with guns and shoot?
Yes, but only just the one's physical, one's harming somebody physical, another one's psychological.
How is it causing someone psychological harm if I am without malice going to sit on some tracks, and I'm going to be just totally limp when they drag me off the tracks, I'm not imposing my viewpoint on anyone, I'm just there.
Did they think about it? Did they notice that you were there?
Well, they had to, yeah. They pulled me off.
Psychological.
How do you call that damage, though? How can you say that's damage? I guess that's my...
It's damage because it shook up the way they were affected. Psychological.
Affected them. I guess I doubted that.
I'm feeling awfully frustrated, Bill. If we're going to talk about violence, we're not getting anywhere. To try to fit it into what we're going to deal with in these passages, if we keep on running around in circles, could you offer some guidance? I'm getting disturbed.
Okay. Yeah, I find it frustrating too. But I think it's more helpful to use your definition than to use my definition, and so sometimes it takes a while. I think what we've got going on right now is perhaps a semantic thing on what's harm and what's effect. So let's just drop it for a second, for the time. Okay. No bodily harm, depending on how you define it, whether or not there's psychological harm. What's going on here for Jesus? I mean, where have these merchants set up their wares?
The temple, in the place of worship.
What part of the temple?
Where the poor people.
Not the poor.
Where?
Part of the temple where the Gentiles would come in.
Where the Gentiles would come into. The temple was, you know, set up, had all these, you know, well, it wasn't, it was more like this, and you know, Gentiles could come here, and women could come here, and the, you know, the good guys, the male Jews could come into this part, and the had set up in the court of the Gentiles so that the Gentiles could not even have a quiet, holy type place to worship, the Gentile proselytes. So Jesus is doing, he doesn't say it in the John passage, but in the Luke passage, my house is to be a house of prayer. Yeah, it's not in the John, is it, that part about house of prayer? Anyhow, he's restoring the temple to its original use. So what he's really doing is helping to create a symbol of unity, that this is to be a house of prayer for all peoples, and the Jews, through their merchandising, have excluded the Gentiles from being able to use it very well for worship. There's no way, I don't think legitimately, that you can say that Jesus used physical harm against any of the merchants there. The temple priests had their own guard. The praetorium, the Roman praetorium, was right across the street. Had there been physical violence going on, Jesus would have been apprehended right there. So I would argue, this is one that's used all the time. Jesus was violent, what about the cleansing of the temple? I would say by our definition of violence, that doesn't fit, Sandy.
Can I ask a question?
it helped me a lot the other night when Keith used this, we were talking about women and violence and dying women and anger. And he explained the text of Jesus expressing anger and anger being a legitimate emotion.
Mm-hmm.
He's saying that just before the passage before in Luke where Jesus wept. And it also helped when he explained that Jesus' anger had, his mission was foremost in his mind, so that he had his mission in mind, and so the anger. Yeah, he had higher motives.
Okay, a higher motive. That's an argument that a lot of people use for use of military. I think that Jesus was angry here. I mean, I agree with that. One of the definitions of the word meek in the Greek, Greek here, praotes, is the person who is meek is a person who is angry at the right time, always, and never at the wrong time. Which helps me to understand, blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. We are called to be angry at certain times, not to defend ourselves. I think Keith talked about that a little bit. But in situations where other people are suffering violence or being harmed, it's legitimate for us to be angry, but not at the wrong time. In the Old Testament, who was called the meekest man on earth? Moses. Okay, we don't think of Moses being meek very often in 20th century American conceptions of meek. But if we think of being angry at the right time and not at the wrong time, I think it's good. Okay. Luke 20, let's look at this one next. Luke 22, 35 to 38. Someone want to read that?
He said to them, "When I sent you out with no purse or bag or sandals, did you lack anything?" They said, "Nothing." He said to them, "But now let him who has a purse take it, and likewise a bag. And let him who has no sword sell his mantle and buy one. For I tell you that this scripture must be fulfilled in me." And he was reckoned with transgressors. "For what is written about me has its fulfillment." And they said to him, "Look, Lord, here are two swords." And he said to them, "It is enough."
Okay, what's the argument in favor of violence here? Go buy a sword. Sounds pretty straightforward. Okay. What are some of your ideas? How do you understand this? Is he saying that Rife is gonna Rife? I did it now, just like my roommate. So many Rife is luff. Life is gonna be rough. I'm not gonna be around anymore. You're gonna be persecuted. So be ready to defend yourself with a sword if necessary. Is that what he's saying?
He's not much of a military man if he is, because he's a lot of fishermen and disciples, and so if he comes by his sword, that's not going to do much for defending himself. Either.
This is in the midst of the passion story. He doesn't let Peter use the sword.
Okay, right after this, as he's being arrested, he pulls out his sword, Peter does, and uses it, and what does Jesus say? Put up your sword. Okay, so it seems to be some contradiction there. So then what is he saying here? If he's not saying that, what is Jesus saying?
I think the key is, it is enough or something, and I don't know exactly what that means by interpretation, where that was somehow, when he said, it is enough, that's got some meaning that would help.
Anybody know?
I wonder.
The other translation for that?
When's RSV?
That is enough, he replied, is what it means.
Okay, that is enough, or enough of this.
Yeah.
Meaning, mm-hmm. you've missed the point again, mm-hmm. just yeah. forget it.
Yeah.
you know. Which is, you know, the way I understand it is, he's speaking metaphorically, and of course that's what we always do to scripture when we want it to say what we want it to say. But he wasn't being literal, he's being metaphorical. But I think in this case he was, just as in Hebrews it says scripture is a sharper than a two-edged sword, or I've come to bring not peace but a sword. I think he's talking about division, or I think what he's saying here is that things are about to get really rough. A storm is about to break over their heads. Be prepared for the same kind of persecution that I'm about to suffer. Be prepared psychologically or whatever way you need to be prepared. They take it, you know, they say, oh, swords. Oh, here we got two swords. He says, enough of this. A little bit later, Peter uses swords. He says, put your sword away, that they really, you know, misunderstood that passage once again. Comments? Okay. Okay, well, we'll just deal with them in order. Matthew 26:52. What is that? Someone read it.
Put your sword. Put your sword back into its place, for all who took the sword will perish by the sword.
Oh, okay. That's the parallel passage we're just talking about. The argument has been made that this is an argument for defensive military. All who take the sword will perish by the sword. People have said, well, it's our responsibility to punish wrongdoers, those who take the sword with the sword. Is that legitimate?
That's taking only half the verse, though. I mean, the other half says, put back your
sword.
Put
away your sword, okay. Anyone want to argue with that? I don't think it's a call by Jesus for us to be the ones responsible to have the people perish by the sword. But the argument has been made, believe me. Okay. Matthew 22:21. Okay, what's the argument here in favor of participation in the military?
Taxes.
Okay, pay taxes. Okay, if the government says to you, serve in the military, you are to serve in the military. Okay.
Kind of a separation between spiritual and...
Okay. Okay, what do you think about that? How do you understand that?
I think because if you look at things, everything belongs to God. So really, since they're pretty much only anything.
Okay.
Coins have two sides. And if you're talking about a coin with Caesar's likeness on it, look at our coins or something. We have "In God We Trust" or something on the back of whatever. And so it's a two-sided coin. And I think that God overrules it all. Like I said,
thought about that before with our coins today. Dorothy Day has said, once you've rendered to Caesar what is God's, I mean, to God what is God's, there's nothing left over for Caesar. Same thing. A quote that has stuck with me for a long time by Jim Douglas in his book called The Nonviolent Cross, which was one of the real formative books in my own coming to grips with this issue of War and Peace. It's in our bookstore. He says that in relation to this verse or this passage, that the scripture must, that the Christian must always remember that it was on Caesar's cross that the Prince of Glory died. And so sometimes, so too the Christian sometimes is called to render unto Caesar a cross rather than a denarius, the coin.
The
nonviolent cross.
You were saying if the things are given to God, there isn't anything left over, Dorothy Day. So, if you are nonviolent, then you don't have any further responsibility to the government about being in the military or whatever.
Okay, well, I think if it... We'll talk about that in relation to this passage too, okay? About being subject to authorities. I'm going to save that one for the last one. Okay. That is a, you know, that's a, I think one of the more ambiguous passages.
Remember, and of
Caesar,
course,
the things
Jesus
that are Caesar.
Talked in parables all the time.
Mm-hmm.
We just never think of that as a parable.
Okay. Okay, anyone want to say more about that passage?
Well, I was just going to say, this passage, what is the context of Jesus' reference to the coin when you think about Dorothy Day saying the coin?
What's the coin?
Dorothy Day saying it was...
Once you've rendered to God what's God's, there's nothing left over for Caesar.
And what was the point with respect to about the coin?
Oh, I remember studying something about this. It was a joke. It was a joke because they weren't supposed to even have one of those coins. It was against the law for them to have one of those coins or something like that. And when he said, "Give me a coin," and they would like the coin, it just showed that they were breaking the law.
Because it had Caesar's image on it.
Yeah.
Caesar was worshipped as God, so they're carrying around an image of a god. So that's the joke, that as soon as they whip out that coin, you know, the people around the crowd are going, oh, he got him, you know, right there before they went on any further. And so as I understand what he's saying, if you're going to compromise to that extent with the authorities that you already have, then go ahead and go all the way, you know, give them the coins, do whatever you need. You've already sold yourself to Caesar. That's how I understand that passage. Okay, ready to go on? Matthew 24:6. What's that one?
You will hear war to the image of war, but see to it that you are not alarmed. When people take it, that it's always going to be war, is why it must be.
That it's all right for Christians to participate?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, anyone want to argue that in favor of that position?
Mine has one other line that says, such things must happen, but the end is still to come.
Mm-hmm.
So the end is still to come. Like, well, your judgment is coming. At least that's...
I guess it's a such things must happen that people always do this. Yeah. If it must happen, you must be given permission.
Mm-hmm.
Luke 3:10-14, the... soldiers come to John the Baptist, you know, say, what must we do? And he says, don't treat anyone harshly, accept your pay. He doesn't tell them to get out of the military. So I think what's going on here, I mean, to say that serving in the military then is really sort of an argument from, what do we call an argument from silence. He didn't say it's okay for you to be in the military, he just didn't say at that moment to get out. That may be somewhat of an ambiguous one too. Is that the right?
No. Yeah. Saul did it also often, and we, what shall we do? And he said to them, rob no one by violence or by false accusation, and be content with your wages.
Yeah. All of these are directed towards individual people. In the New Testament,
okay.
In the Old Testament, God is speaking to many people.
Okay.
He says, rob no one by violence. Why does he say that to the military? Were they used to going around and robbing people?
As I understand, yeah, the people that they're you know, the subjects that were not their own people, but for instance, they were occupying Palestine, so they pretty much could do what they wanted.
He's definitely speaking against violence.
He's using violence, but he's not telling them, you know, get out of the army, no. Which is the argument there. So I think this is one perhaps a little bit ambiguous too. That some pacifists, you know, would like him to have said, and by the way, find a new profession. But he didn't say that, or at least it's not recorded yet.
Was it a choice to be in the army at that time?
Well, these are Roman centurions, so.
I know later there was sort of a draft, because Christians resisted it to the point of death. So I would presume it was not a choice at this time, but I don't know. Okay. Do we find anything here in specifically in the Gospels that are going to argue in favor, do you think legitimately in favor of military service or violent use of violence, violence even in defense? Okay, I think it's important. I mean, the point to looking at those passages is to see the passages that have been used to justify use of violence and see if you think that's legitimate. There's a chapter in this book here that covers, that deals with each of those passages plus a few others. No greater service, no greater love has any man than to lay down his life for his friends, that passage. And a few others. Okay, Romans 13. Be subject, it's a long passage, I think it's an important one. Be subject to the authorities.
1-7.
Okay, usually we look at Romans 13, 1-7. Let's take a look there. Five, therefore one must be subject, not only to avoid God's wrath, but also for the sake of conscience. For the same reason, you also pay taxes, for the authorities or ministers of God attending to this very thing. Pay all of them their dues, taxes to whom taxes are due, revenue to whom revenue is due, respect to whom respect is due, honor to whom honor is due.
You know, this kind of stuff, Luther, this is how he was inspired by the book of Romans, you know. And his two-kingdom theory, I mean, our whole Lutheran tradition, you know, we're not a pacifist church by any means. We're not a, you're not Lutheran either, so.
Sorry, go ahead.
I don't know. That's where I kind of come to knock heads with my own tradition. The question, this whole question of peacemaking. I don't know if any of you else just feel that way.
What do you do with this passage?
Well, what if you put more emphasis on verse 3? For the rulers are not or rulers are not a terror to good conduct, to bad.
Okay.
So, I mean, there he's kind of clarifying the institutions that exist are being, rather than using the word, just because they're there, they're to be used. God can use those institutions, but they are there to for order, for to observe good conduct. But once the this passage says to me, if they existing and are conducting for bad conduct, then the institutions should be brought into question.
Okay.
So the policy, the institution may be bad, but yet the policy, the separation of the policy that the institution is putting forth as opposed to the institution itself. Mm-hmm.
For rulers are not a terror to good conduct, but some rulers are. Would you say that?
Some rulers
are a terror to good conduct. In which case, this passage might not be applicable. Seeing if that's what you're saying. Okay. Yeah, Romans 13 is a big help in understanding Germany under Nazism. And unfortunately, the Lutheran tradition of not calling into question rulers.
Except
the Barman? The theological, the Barman Conference Declaration. Okay, so, Sandy, go ahead. And the very last verse of chapter 12, do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. Mm-hmm. And when Paul wrote this, we didn't have chapters and verses in here. Chapter separations didn't come into like the 6th century and verses till 13th or something like that. So we tend to take Romans 13, 1 to 7, conk, forgetting, what comes right before it. And again, right after it, verse 8, oh, no one anything except to love one another. Or whoever loves one's neighbor has fulfilled the law.
But then I still see the problem. I don't know. I'm trying to remember for that not of our time. But let's say.
A couple other things taken. I'm hurrying now time wise here. Acts 5:29 or 26. The apostles have been getting. This is after Jesus' death and resurrection and ascension. The apostles have been getting into trouble with the authorities because they're preaching and creating all sorts of havoc. And the Jewish authorities call them in and say, you guys have got to stop preaching. And their response is, we must obey God rather than people. Okay, I think that's an antidote or something to keep in mind at the same time, sort of dialectical tension with this Romans 13, we must obey God rather than people, that where the authorities are not being consistent with God's will, we need to be faithful right to God. That what I think what Romans 13 is saying is, in every case possible, get along with the government. Don't raise unnecessary problems for yourself, but certainly Jesus died a political criminal. So did Paul. Paul was not subject to the authorities all of his life. I mean, as push came to shove and he was given the choice of being faithful to God or faithful to the authorities, he was not faithful to the authorities. Or he wouldn't have died. Neither would Jesus. I think we need really, and the whole Beatitudes are also in tension with this passage from Romans 13.
It sounds like the Beatitudes.
Well, Romans 12 does.
Yes.
Yeah, not Romans, not so much Romans 13.
Isn't there also the one way you can take Romans 13 as Paul is really trying to avoid violence? Because mm-hmm. he was trying to keep them from causing mm-hmm. real upheaval with the Roman government at that time.
Yep.
And so he's...
I,
very different situation than your own government.
Yeah, okay. I think, if anything, this is an argument in favor of police power, more so than armies. We don't have a lot of time to talk about that question of police. My own feeling is one I still wrestle with. As I mentioned, I don't believe as a Christian I can participate in military or believe that our standing armies and things like that are a good idea. And I'm still wrestling with the whole question of police power. The one thing as I look at, you know, the Chelan Police Department, you know, doesn't make war on the Wenatchee Police Department. But you carry that analogy too far, you get into a real sticky situation. So I don't have a good answer for that. I think certainly some changes need to be made in our criminal justice system, particularly the prison system, but I'm not willing to, at this moment, to say all the police officers in the United States ought to throw away their guns, and so maybe I'm being inconsistent.
Except the way it's unjustly used in South Africa, which we support.
Right.
That's not a police I support at all.
No, I agree.
In Britain, do they? The bottom still just got
bumped away. More and more they are armed now with pistols. Quickly, some basic New Testament principles against violence, what we looked at here were some isolated, I would call isolated passages that occasionally have been used in favor of use of military. I think there's some broad principles that run throughout the New Testament against it. Love of neighbor and enemy. This is the important part, is the and enemy. Okay, Matthew 5:11 and 46-48. And that passage just now from Romans 12. Okay. God is parent of all. Infinite value of each human being. Matthew 5:44. Matthew 10:29-31. And certainly the example of Jesus' life and death. That he had presumably a number of opportunities to use violence and didn't. You know, right at the end, do you not think I could call down 12 legions of angels to fight for me? Consistently chose the way of suffering servanthood. What I think is a real important point. The first 3 centuries of the Christian church, well, the early Christian church spoke what language, primarily? Well, not really, because most of the early Christian church was not Jewish, but Gentile.
Greek,
okay. The vast majority. And even for those who were Jews, the official language, the common language, overarching language, was Greek. What was our New Testament written in?
Greek,
okay.
So they
not they well they I would argue understood the New Testament at least as well as we do, because it was written in their daily language. And for the first 3 centuries of the church, really until Constantine, the church was, with few exceptions, pacifist.
that the church teaching was clearly you could not use violence even to defend yourself. Even to defend yourself. If you were attacked, you could not use violence as self-defense. That was the official church teaching. And so I would suggest that anyone who argues that the New Testament favors or allows, maybe not favors, but allows violence, the burden of proof is really on those people. Because the early church who spoke Greek, the language that the texts were written in, said, no, this is saying no use of violence. Until Christianity became the official religion under Constantine, which I would argue was about the worst thing that could ever happen to the church, is to become the official religion of any country.